concerning a predisposition toward alcoholism and addictive behavior, new studies seem to indicate it is how we are treated and shown emotional context and modeling that determines how we move forward. Although many of us may have come from less than ideal family situations, sponsors remind us that we, not our families, are working this step as we are right now. It makes sense that if we never learned to handle our feelings, we'd have to find a way to get by. Drugs, sex, alcohol, or something. If we came from a family that denied, kept secrets, shamed, repressed and suppressed, physically, emotionally, or sexually abused us, or took part in any number of other ways of creating distortion in emotional, physical, and sexual responses, odds are our sex life is goofy and has been for a long time. Many of us confuse having sex with being intimate. Many of us think that being accepted sexually is the same as being loved, only to be disappointed again and again. Many of us use sex to act out our aggression and hate of the opposite sex in many different acts and obsessions. Men in particular seem to be drawn toward pornography and can have very active fantasy lives with very little contact with reality. Advertising and the media have molded and shaped our perceptions of what is and is not a normal love life and how people relate to each other. If we grew up without a good model for intimacy, we may think of some of the junk we see on TV, in the movies, and in the print ads is how people really behave and relate. If so, we are in for a long and confusing journey. Lust, and all the areas associated with love and sex, is an area we need to closely examine in the light of our spiritual values. What do we really think of other people? Are they objects to be used and discarded, to be fondled and played with? Or are they people with feelings and hearts and depth to be cherished and nurtured and honored, just as we would wish to be? How do we treat the people we love, warmly and openly and with respect, or as badly as we wish, since after all we love them and they love us and they have to put up with us? It is natural to have sexual drives and desires. It is part of being a spiritual being to express love through the body, openly, affectionately, passionately, and freely. In light of those spiritual values, it is important to examine monogamy. With sexually transmitted diseases being fatal or permanent now, it also is prudent to practice safe sex under all circumstances and all the aspects of being a sexual spiritual person. We are reminded what the Big Book says about sex on page 69. We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. What comes from our higher power is to be honored and treated with respect. Our sexuality has unlimited potential for good. We have so often turned this power in on ourselves and been destroyed by it or allowed it to destroy others. The sixth and seventh steps let us change our feelings about sex so that these new feelings can encourage wholesome relationships. When we walk with our higher power, our self-will doesn't run riot over our sex lives. Our spiritual awakening washes over all our relationships, even our most tender and personal. Working on our own shortcomings allows us to gain a new sense of respect. We learn we can indeed love deeply. We find that sexuality is a powerful, life-giving force that enriches, bonds, and commits us to a special person. We no longer have to face remorse and guilt from uncontrolled, self-driven lust. May we discover the joy in our God-given sexuality by treating ourselves and others with honor and respect. Being spiritual does not mean being celibate or chaste. It may include these elements for different reasons and practices, but our body is as holy as our spirit and can celebrate the gift of love just as fully in harmony with all aspects of the spirit and love. We need to look closely at how we relate to people. Do we dislike the opposite sex? Do we fear or hate our own sex? How do we identify ourselves as a sexual being? Once we are in a relationship with someone, does our behavior change? Do we quit trying, showing our feelings, and giving fully? Do we honor and respect the other person and the relationship? Once again, the more we know about our ways of dealing with the world and the people in it, the better we will be able to become entirely ready. Peter shares this observation about relationships and recovery. My first sponsor was a very interesting guy. He had been around the program for a while, was a hard-driving businessman, and was used to living fast and loose. He'd been married a long time to the same woman and had some pretty sexist ideas. He and another guy and I used to go to meetings with each other a lot, work together and saw each other socially, sometimes with our wives. My first sponsor used to go to Las Vegas pretty often with his brother and his dad and my other friend. When they were in Vegas, they would do business with prostitutes. None of them saw this as cheating on their wives, as it was a professional relationship. It got me thinking, however. When I got up on my high horse and judged my sponsor for his behavior, how was it that much different than my reading Playboy and looking at lingerie calendars? Was there that much difference between rationalizing a professional relationship and rationalizing a magazine or calendar? Wasn't it still making a sexual object out of a human being and demeaning my current relationship? What was it doing to me and my current relationship with God? I really had to ask for help to become entirely ready so I could let go of my attitudes and beliefs around sexuality and love that were sexist, belittling, and not in line with my spiritual values. I want to be in line with my values. I must ask for help. The last deadly defect or sin we will look at is anger. Anger is a difficult emotion for a lot of us to deal with because of how we were taught to deal with anger as children. Since it was not possible to show our anger toward adults, many of us have learned to deny, repress, substitute, and suppress anger. Many of us have carried this into our present situations. We never saw ourselves as angry people. We were intense, and occasionally we'd get mad, but we certainly didn't see ourselves as angry. One of the many program slogans says, "Anger is but one letter away from danger." Many of us nursed long-standing resentments. Every time we thought about them, we got angry. What makes anger so dangerous is that it burns without consuming. It feeds on itself until it overwhelms all other emotions. Anger is poison. When anger takes over, it acts with uncontrollable rage. We say things, feel things, and do things way out of proportion. Anger is emotional drunkenness. Sarah shares her experience with anger and resentments. I always knew that I was hot-tempered and I had a short fuse, but I never viewed myself as angry. I guess I should have realized I had an anger problem when I first went to treatment. I was angry when they told me that I couldn't drink. I was there because I had a drug problem, and how dare they tell me that I can't drink. I had a rebellious attitude, especially toward authority figures. I used to deal with my anger one of two ways. I was hot, explosive, enraged, hostile, or furious, or I was cold, denying and suppressing my anger. I learned that those two ways were unskillful and had negative impacts on my life. I was very sarcastic. I still am working on that because the definition of sarcasm is a cutting, often ironic remark intended to wound. And that goes against my values. I also had a lot of loud arguments with physical fights, hot, or else I experienced severe depression, headaches, and stomach aches, cold. After I spent 2 years trying to stop starting in the program, I usually relapsed at 6 months, I decided that there were some character defects I needed to deal with. I had turned so much of my anger inward that I was ashamed of myself and my behaviors. I also believed a lot of things happened to me through no fault of my own, that I was a victim. That caused me pain that I had never dealt with. I also had a large list of resentments. Step 6 is about the principle of willingness, and I became willing to make some changes. I needed to deal with the character defects of sarcasm, fear, rage, control, and anger. To me, that means don't do what I want to do. Step 7 is about humility, and I knew I needed help getting the good things. Happiness, joy, freedom, honesty, unselfishness, and purity. Again, I interpret that to be doing what I don't want to do. I need to act out of love instead of fear or anger. I decided it was time to change. I listened to the advice from someone in the program, and I went to a 5-day seminar on anger and resentments. I learned skillful ways to deal with anger. Because anger stems from fear, if I identify the fear, I can deal with the underlying issue. I also use meditation as a way to deal with my anger. I focus on my breathing and use other techniques for forgiving myself or smiling at situations that make me angry. As for my resentments, I decided to take back control of my feelings and let go of my need to punish the people that had wronged me. I no longer had to re-feel the pain from my old hurts. One night after a meeting, someone told me, "Resentment is me taking the poison and waiting for them to die." I'm no longer at the jumping-off place, wanting to die. It's time to let go and let God. My sponsor suggested that I pray for the people I have resentments toward, ask God to give them what they deserve, and eventually ask God to give them the same things I ask for myself. Being honest about my anger, first with myself and then with others, has allowed me to own my mistakes and to deal with my anger in a skillful manner. I didn't make these changes overnight, and I didn't do it alone. With my higher power as my guide, I have slowly begun the process of change. Now, with 18 months clean time, I am becoming the person he wants me to be. I believe the most satisfactory years of my existence lie ahead. Because we are in recovery doesn't mean we won't get angry, but the sixth and seventh steps give us a process of working through anger. We learn that what usually fuels anger is fear and guilt. We can dissolve anger. The remedy for fear is faith, for faith means courage. When we are ready to replace our anger with faith, the fear and guilt that cause the anger is worked through and the anger is removed. Courage is what makes us do the right thing even when nobody else is doing it. We can find happiness while surrounded by darkness. We can be more loving in the middle of hate and envy, and more serene when surrounded by chaos, fear, and anger. The ideas of the sixth and seventh steps help us face impossible odds. We learn that any act of courage may produce future victory for ourselves and others. The courage, which we want, takes its strength from faith, not from bravery or physical power. Let truth and faith, our readiness and humble quest, give us courage so that when fear knocks, no one is there. One word often heard in group discussions is willingness. Yet the willingness to do something cannot exist without the specific action required to do it, and that takes courage. Courage to build our character. It is courage that turns possibilities into realities and assures us that progress in improving our character is possible. Experience teaches us that courage keeps our character defects under control. When courage guides our willingness, we can be sure that we will not only be capable of accomplishing success, but that we are also worthy of it. When we know that a goal is worth going for, courage has judgment and carefulness as allies, even though we may be moving against the tide of popular opinion. Many of the people we come into contact with in our lives who don't live by any program or belief think our 12-step way of life is trite and full of silly slogans and ideas. We can't be concerned with opinions about our way of life, even if others think it's trite, because this way of living life has become our secret to life. We overcome our fears about setting and working toward goals. It helps us to remember courage is fear that has said its prayers. The fact is, underneath all the denial and rationalization, most of us were in a constant rage, seething. For many of us in recovery, we carry a huge load of anger without realizing it. Many of us stuff anger away like putting hungry dogs in the basement. Sooner or later, we open the basement door to express a little anger, and the hungry dogs slip out. We move into a rage out of proportion to what triggered the anger, and most of the time we don't have a clue as to what happened. Anger is a common defect in our attitudes and personalities. Like all other character defects, anger grows more harmful the longer it is contained. Unless we expose it freely for others to see, it can consume all of our good intentions. We must get the monkey off our backs before it reaches our throats. How can we possibly make peace and form worthwhile relationships unless we bring anger into the open by working steps 6 and 7? Letting go of hidden anger and returning to a stable state of mind is one of the first actions in finding a much more comfortable and acceptable peace with life. We find that letting it all out through the 6th and 7th steps is the way to become freer and happier. We continue to take daily personal assessments of our spiritual growth by monitoring our anger. The old truism of what to do when we become angry, to count to 10, helps us practice the letting go process of the 6th and 7th steps and become better suited in dealing with anger in an appropriate way. Anger and fear are closely tied together, and many of us in the program learn to handle our fear with booze, drugs, food, and many other mood-altering behaviors. Now that we are in recovery, we have to learn new ways of coping with fear and anger. We need to learn healthy ways of expressing anger. One of the biggest risks to a person in recovery is self-righteous anger. We become very dangerous to ourselves and others when we are right. Being right used to mean a free check to treat a person who was wrong any way we chose. Especially if we loved that person, it meant we could really cause havoc in the name of being right. Most of us never learn that right doesn't mean exclusive. There are many ways of being right. We just assumed that there was only one way. We were taught that by our parents, our places of worship, and our schools. As we move into our birthright as spiritual beings, we discover that right is a cage, not a freedom. Being right is a perspective, not a license for angry behavior. Each of us has a unique perspective, thank God, and therefore a unique way of being right. We must learn to temper our anger based on self-righteousness and learn to open our minds and hearts to different points of view. It doesn't mean we won't get angry. It just means we won't hurt others so often with our rightness. In looking at anger as a character defect, it is important to realize that anger is a legitimate emotion. To deny all anger in the name of spiritual growth is as unhealthy as being angry all the time in the name of being right. We get angry. We need to learn how to express that anger in a healthy, non-damaging manner. It is the inappropriate expression of anger and the out-of-proportion expression of anger that is a defect and causes us and others harm. It was at a meeting that an old-timer said, "I am punished by my defects of character, not because I have them." Newcomers can be puzzled by that comment for a long time. How could we be punished by our defects? Then it dawns on them. God doesn't need to keep a watch on us and note our defects. Our defects keep us from becoming all that we can become and limit our ability to grow. Joe McHugh reminds us, "When we have taken the first 5 steps, it is at this point that many people make the mistake of turning it over to God and expecting God to apply steps 6 and 7 to their lives. But these are our steps. God doesn't need to take steps 6 and 7. We do. Lack of power is our dilemma. Anger and the other 6 sins keeps us from God. Without God, we lack the power to live." Another view of this is the story about Buddha talking to some of his students about anger. Buddha said, "Anger is like picking up a burning coal with the intention of throwing it at another person. We are the ones who get burned in the process." Let's take a look at Joe's story. "Before my recovery began 5 years ago, the 7 deadly sins accurately described my basic character. After my last drink, I discovered to my amazed awakening that the 7 deadly sins accurately described human nature. Were steps 6 and 7 going to change my basic human nature? I doubted it. So it took me 4 years of somewhat miserable dryness to get to the 7th step prayer. But then I was in for some surprises. 7 of them. Slowly, very slowly, at a caterpillar pace, I realized, I love program realizations, that God is in the transformation business. Before I was even fully aware of it, a change was taking place in my behavior. As a drinking author, I took great pride in my work. My pride far surpassed my accomplishments. My ego was always fatter than my bank account. Through recovery, I have learned to write what I like and to like what I write. I no longer reach for the proverbial brass ring or yearn to write the nation's next bestseller. I've lowered my sights and have found my true niche. I am content, and I like myself more this way. Surprise! Step 7 has changed pride into self-esteem. Did I mention yearning for literary fame and fortune? Well, I never worked towards such a goal. I wrote for money. My sole motive was personal gain, no more, no less. Today, I write from a new heart with a listener's mental and spiritual welfare in mind. Surprise! Caring and sharing have replaced selfishness. When I was a drinking drunk, I firmly believed that lust was a natural part of the human makeup. I often wrote highly of it, using acceptable euphemisms such as eros, passion, fervent love, and burning desire. It wasn't until sobriety in my 3rd marriage that I could respect, trust, adore, obey, or be true to a loving woman. My grandiose ego is far less grandiose. I now enjoy what I once thought was a contradiction in terms, moral sex. Surprise! Love has conquered lust. Anger was my middle name. Getting even was the name of my game. My bywords were, "I'll show them," and "Who do they think they are?" and "They aren't going to get away with that." This violent need to punish others blinded me to the rights of others. Sober, I learned that all people are as human as I am and no more deserving of my self-righteous anger than I am of theirs. Surprise! Anger has given way to tolerance. I was a glutton for everything sensual, including the pleasure of intoxication. As it turned out, I was really a glutton for punishment, drinking anything from beer and wine to whiskey and on one pitiful occasion aftershave lotion. I wanted more of everything in sight, no matter what it was. I was worse than an underprivileged kid let loose in an unguarded candy store. I was an insatiable sponge. Today, thanks to Step 7, I no longer pray to have what I want. I pray to want what I have. Surprise! Acceptance has displaced gluttony. Don't do today what you can put off till tomorrow. Remember that kind of barroom advice? I do. I lived by it. Even in sobriety, I found myself procrastinating with the steps, slow to read, study, and understand the programs outlined in the big book, faint-hearted about attending meetings, in other words, dragging my feet. That's why it took me 4 years to get to Step 7. Yet this is when I discovered that I would rather make a meeting than watch TV, that I prefer the big book to novels, that I'd rather pray than think. Surprise! The joy of living has replaced sloth. Today I understand envy as the incredible sadness that overwhelmed me when others were successful. I was hypercritical and insanely jealous of the greats, never once looking at the time, energy, and work they put into their success. I simply resented their good luck, connections, or secret. Today I find myself admiring hard-working people who make it. There was a time, by the way, when I resented the winners in the program. I now let them serve as examples for me. Surprise! I stick with the winners. Envy is being replaced by inspiration. Today I live in a daily state of surprise as Step 6 and 7 work on me. I have surrendered to the spiritual process that neutralizes character defects. Someday, maybe mine will be removed. As I said at the beginning, I move at a caterpillar pace. But that's okay today. As a slow-moving caterpillar spinning my cocoon to the design of the 12 steps, I will emerge free as a butterfly. That's a promise God always keeps. We take a look at the part anger plays in our life and how appropriate our expression of anger is. Are we right a lot? Are we upset and judgmental a lot? Are people afraid of us? Do we punish people with our rightness? We look at anger and its consequences and then move toward being entirely ready to let it go. It is time now to put this discussion into balance and prepare to move on to the 7th step. We have asked a lot of hard questions. We examined some pretty difficult areas of living. We've decided to look for excess in our lives. We are now ready to take action. What exactly does that mean? Can you see why it says in the 12 and 12 that this is the step that separates the men and women, winners from the boys and girls, losers? It is gut check time. Are we ready to change our ways of living or not? It is not a maybe proposition. It is fish or cut bait. Let's fill that big self-centered hole in our being with spiritual usefulness. Perhaps many of us have approached this step and the one to follow in a less active manner. Odds are we may still be battling some pretty major defects in our life, too. This step requires commitment and specific action. There is no better time to get to it than right now. As we're taught in the 12 steps, the chief activator of our defects has been self-centered fear, mainly fear that we would lose something we already possessed or that we would fail to get something we demanded. Living on the basis of unsatisfied demands, we obviously were in a state of continual disturbance and frustration. Therefore, we are taught there will be no peace unless we are able to reduce these demands. We hear in the program that F-E-A-R equals frustration, ego, anxiety, and resentment. We don't want to return to the life we led before recovery, but fear should never be the reason why we don't. Fear keeps us from being open to the program and from being entirely ready. If we're only in recovery because we're afraid of returning to the old way of life, we'll never pay attention and open our hearts to learn about the new. We'll be too busy looking back over our shoulders to make sure the old life isn't creeping up on us. We have to want the program out of a desire for a new life, not out of fear for the old. Positive thinking and behavior will be in charge if we are to make any character growth. Every fear encourages negative thinking that can destroy us. Guilt and shame come from the past, just like fear. If those feelings are what drive us, we will never grow. The 6th and 7th steps let us examine our fears. We learn to take an inventory of each fear until we understand what causes it. Then we will be able to find a way to work through it. How do we reduce our fears? How do we move into graceful living and growth towards spiritual expression? The answers lie in our ability to become humble and trust, through the seventh step. In concluding our discussion on step six, we hear from Joe McHugh, who tells a favorite story. Joe McHugh on Stripping Away. I have a pretty rocking chair down in my office. When I first bought the building, someone had run off and left the chair behind. There wasn't anything else there of value, but there was this old rocking chair. It was just a horrible-looking mess, painted black with one of the rungs broken out of the back of it. I decided I'd keep it, thinking maybe one of these days I might put it together. Quite a few years went by, and it just sat in the attic. Several times, some of the guys tempted me to throw it away. In fact, I'd find it around by the dumpster, and I'd bring it back, saying I was going to look at it one of these days. I finally got this old rocking chair out of the attic and into the light downstairs so I could really see it. And as I began to look at it, I saw that it was a really fine chair. I got some paint stripper and I began to strip it. I stripped all the paint away and found that it was solid oak. I took the old raggedy bottom that had been covered over many, many times with different cloth and tacks, and I tore it off and threw it away. There was one broken rung, and I made an identical one by bending one and putting it in there. I sanded and refinished this chair. Finally, I took it to the upholstery shop. I asked the man there how much it would cost to put a nice white velvet bottom in it. He looked at it and said, "I'll be glad to put it in there. But before I fix it, I'll offer you $350 for that chair." That beautiful, valuable chair was always there. It was there all the time. It was simply covered up. That chair has always been beautiful since the day the furniture maker made it. And that's the way I am, and you are, with God's life inside us. God made us this way, beautiful and valuable. Like the rocking chair, over a period of years, I covered myself up with all sorts of things and made a big mess. The steps of this program have enabled me to uncover, discover, and discard. It's a program of getting rid of things to get down to what we want. It's not a program of getting anything. It's a program of getting rid of things, uncovering, discovering, and discarding. Step 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The key ingredient in living the seventh step is humility. There is not another subject in the program that causes more confusion than humility. It seems that every old-timer has his or her favorite definition. We all seem to get humility and humiliation confused, and many of us have a stereotypical idea of humility, a spiritual pauper wearing sackcloth and ashes. The 12-step way of life is humble, but not in any way meek. The picture many of us have of a humble person is someone afraid of his or her own shadow, whose self-image is so low that this person is afraid to stand up for him or herself. We learn that this image of humility is not what is meant in the program. We realize that the people who have stayed abstinent for some time practice a degree of humility that was foreign to them prior to recovery. For those who have made progress in their program, humility is simply a clear recognition of what and who they are. They have gotten down to their own right size. Humility is understanding that they're worthwhile. It's the middle ground between the extremes of grandiosity and intense shame. They have a sincere desire to be and become the best they can be. Today we remember that humility is not being meek. It is being our true selves. Humility for us means staying our right size and remembering we are as humble as we are grateful. For our definition, we will use this idea from Sam Shoemaker: humility equals gratitude. Humility is an attitude. As such, it must be practiced to be maintained, and it must become a discipline to be developed, just like every other attitude. In developing humility, we are faced once again with an active surrender. In asking God to remove our shortcomings, we must move and act in a manner that reflects our willingness and surrender. To do this requires spiritual values, service, perspective beyond our addiction to alcohol, drugs, food, sex, and so on, to the addictive nature of our lives. Asking through prayer and being willing to receive through humility. Trust, asking for help. Overcoming fear. Understanding and trusting the process. Dealing with stress. Responsibility, action. Solution-focused thinking. We will discuss these aspects of the seventh step and find a method for making this step a foundation for the rest of our lives. The first aspect of the seventh step we'll look at is spiritual values. Part of this discussion must be a clearer focus on humility. What exactly is humility? The dictionary defines humility as the state or quality of being humble of mind or spirit, absence of pride or self-assertion, or acts of self-abasement. Humble is defined as having or showing a consciousness of one's defects or shortcomings, not proud, not self-assertive, modest. Obviously, the second definition of humble is almost a word-for-word restatement of the purpose of the sixth step, to become entirely ready, conscious. So if we practice the sixth step, humility will result. That seems to make sense, doesn't it? Still, it seems as if something is missing here. Humility is our acceptance of ourselves. It is strange how we can go to school and learn a lot of facts, but never learn much along the way about ourselves. We can take up nursing, teaching, counseling, and giving ourselves to the needs of others while never having our own needs met. Why does it seem as if it is easier to solve the problems of the world than to solve our own problems? Why do we love the drama of focusing on our problems? We simply don't know ourselves very well. When we look into a mirror and attempt to understand ourselves, our conclusions about what we see are usually very different from what a friend sees. When we finally work the sixth and seventh steps and take the time and make ourselves a priority, we usually make a startling discovery. There exists within us, at all times, a higher power that is the builder of all successes and our comforter during times of trial. Many of us believe the understanding of ourselves is in direct relation to our understanding and contact with our higher power. The image we see and the identity we have is one of humility before that power. Humility is our acceptance of ourselves based on our continual surrender. An aspect of humility that is often talked about at meetings is that of being teachable. If we are humble, we are open to new ideas and new ways of seeing things. Open-mindedness is a very important part of humility. We don't know it all. There is still more we can learn, and maybe even more important, some we need to unlearn. Yet how many of us in the program aren't open to new ideas and thoughts? Especially after having been around a while, how many do we see who continue to say and do the exact same things year after year? It seems that many of us resist a clear idea of humility so we don't have to conform to it. This is a good illustration of how humility worked in Joan's recovery. What is it about Step 7 that causes so much confusion and apathy? How come we can be in the program for years and still not have a good idea what this step means? Are we so blinded by pride that we can't see the beauty of humility and the benefits of this step? Who needs humility anyway? The idea that I might need humility is not a new one. Even during the years of my active addiction, with the lying and bragging, it was not all that uncommon for someone to tell me to get real. Not a bad working definition for humility, I think. After I started in recovery, my sponsor was fond of pointing out that my way was what landed me in so much difficulty. Maybe it was time to look for another way. The word humbly is awfully hard for me to swallow. Besides that, there is something else that made Step 7 an obstacle for me. It calls for yet one more contact with God, and one that is open and willing for change. This is not just about having an attitude or being ready. This is about being serious about change and doing something about it. No wonder we avoid dealing with this step. In the process of working the first through the six steps, I gained an ability to move through my fear and look toward God. I learned to talk honestly and openly in meetings, and to share my limits and fears with another human in an inventory. With the seventh, however, the situation is different. It is suggesting that since I've done the groundwork, now is the time to humbly ask to change those things that stand in my way. I was very afraid of approaching God this way. I don't know why. After all, this is the God who saved me and let me move into the program and begin a new life. Why was I balking? I had to stop in the middle of working the seventh step and do a mini inventory. I found that I had relapsed into an old form of pride. I was angry with my inability to work out my shortcomings on my own. I knew I had to relearn that if I stuck to my way of thinking and doing, I was doomed to repeatedly hook into my shortcomings. I had to get real. I've heard so many of my fellow members in recovery talk about how they had a religious upbringing but abandoned it during their active addictions, and how hard it was to even investigate a spiritual life again. I, too, was brought up in a very religious environment and have had to set it aside to reconnect with a new reality. My background also included a good dose of the work ethic that I was to be self-reliant and a self-starter. If it could be done, I could do it. Between these two forms of teaching, I became convinced that life was manageable and that with enough hard work and a proper religious attitude, my life could even be rewarding. Boy, was I in for a surprise. I had no openness of mind, no emotional or spiritual perspective for growth, no awareness that it could be any different. When I became willing to start looking at these issues in recovery, it was from a much different viewpoint. It shouldn't have been surprising that it was difficult to develop humility given the circumstances, but it was. I was used to arrogantly demanding spiritual enlightenment or groveling melodramatically for forgiveness. It was a whole different way of being to move toward humility. Gentleness and patience were new to me. Thank God that by working through the steps and opening up to any amount of humility I was capable of, things began to change. Humility became a goal and a quality rather than an obstacle and an obnoxious trait. I've come to know the seventh step as an action step that moves one into humility. By asking, we become humble, and the more we ask and open up, the more humility we can receive. These are the ideas that lead me into the area of God readiness and the ability to change and grow by asking. Another part of humility is represented in service. Over and over again, we are told that through service we will enhance our recovery while at the same time help someone else. By focusing on the needs of others as they see them, we respond in a way that is useful and helpful. In responding to the needs of others, as we would have them respond to us, we superimpose our values and our way of living on theirs. We see value in giving our way. We don't understand why it isn't received in the same manner. We aren't practicing humility. It is said that in about the same degree as we are helpful, we will be happy. The service work we are called to do in recovery is a result of our spiritual awakening. When most of us thought of service, we thought of restaurant help, chores around the house, or washing windows. The thought of service was burdensome, if not downright irritating. We probably schemed throughout our lives to do as little service as possible. Every moment we gave to someone else was one less we could spend on ourselves. This stands to reason, for we were totally self-centered. Even those of us who acted as if we cared normally received much more than we gave. The message in the sixth and seventh steps produces other-centeredness. We, by the grace of God, care less about ourselves and more about our fellows. In the words of Joe McHugh, we are born to help one another. When we pass on our recovery, we keep it. This spiritual paradox becomes an all-determining reality for us. To keep what we have found, we must give it away. Service becomes a way of life. It is suggested that it might pay to reevaluate our 12-step work and other service work in this light. What is truly humble? Is it being open to learning from those we serve? Or is it assuming that we have the better way to give, and if they don't receive it, well, we're still sober, so it was a good experience? This step requires us to look very closely at those values we hold and how we model those values to others. If humility, being humble, is valuable to us, then we must learn to model it. Practice humility. We do the sixth step by surrendering to becoming entirely ready and conscious of our defects and shortcomings. Then the seventh step becomes natural. What other values, spiritual and otherwise, do we hold, and how do we demonstrate them? Have we examined closely the meaning and purpose of our life? The sixth and seventh steps are really asking us what is important to us. And if it is so important, where does it show in our life? Here is where we have to get to the basics. It is easy to avoid this and think we've worked the steps, but if we don't look closely at the meaning and purpose of what we're doing, the whole context of our action loses its value. We must ask ourselves hard questions, just as in the sixth step. What is the value in our life? How is our life giving meaning to others? Are we helping? Are we part of the solution or part of the problem? How does it show? How is our higher power part of our life, and how does it show? What value do we give to spirituality, and how does it show? From the answers to these questions comes our ability to share, give, act, and practice humility. Let's look at Sam's experience. I have learned from experience that staying abstinent, working the program, and attending meetings through painful times is a guarantee of personality change. We no longer have to escape our pain through using. The program has given us a previous tool, humility, which used regularly will transform pain into growth. Armed with humility, we who once dreaded change as much as death can learn to face real life with a new courage and hope. Before I entered the fellowship, I lived in a fantasy world of my own creation. I attempted to control not only effort but outcomes of situations. I tried to keep myself calm with chemicals and food, with no recognition for the ups and downs of daily living. I was seeking an unreal world of complete security, romance, and approval, and the more I tried to control, demand these things, the more chaos I created. It becomes clear to us in getting sober that we have to change. I like what Bill W. has to say about these rude awakenings in this passage from the 12 and 12. And as we grow spiritually, we find that our old attitudes toward our instincts need to undergo drastic revisions. Our desires for emotional security and wealth, for personal prestige and power, for romance and for family satisfactions, all these have to be tempered and redirected. We have learned that the satisfaction of instincts cannot be the sole end and aim of our lives. If we place instincts first, we have got the cart before the horse. We shall be pulled backward into disillusionment. But when we are willing to place spiritual growth first, then and only then do we have a real chance. Humility seems to be the basic ingredient for transforming pain into growth. In step 7 of the 12 and 12, humility is defined as the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values have to come first, and that material satisfactions are not the purpose of living. We learn that an honest desire to seek and do God's will is necessary for humility. What an order! I can't go through with it. Used to be my initial reaction to growing through the steps. I could accept solutions intellectually, but when it came to practical application, I had trouble. I know today that I don't have to do it perfectly. It takes time to get better. I know that I don't have to do it alone, that I have a wealth of wisdom and support in this fellowship at my disposal, and that gives me hope for change, growth, and new frontiers. The next aspect of the seventh step we'll discuss is that of perspective. Bill W. addressed this issue of perspective in a very famous A.A. Grapevine article in the 1950s about emotional sobriety. He was afraid that many people were missing the point of the 12 steps by focusing so narrowly on the addictive practice that brought them to the program, in his case, alcohol. As it points out in the Big Book, alcohol, or drugs, sex, food, gambling, and so on, is just a symptom. The underlying disease is much more subtle and insidious than the gross outer behaviors might suggest. It raises the question of what the additive behavior is masking. Those in recovery must be doubly on guard against compulsive behavior and mood altering through habitual activities or substances. In light of what Bill W. said about emotional sobriety and the symptom of the disease, it is imperative that members open their perspective to a larger view. The nature of the seventh step asks us to humbly be willing and let go and practice what we learned. If we must defend a lifestyle that appears to be unhealthy and addictive, are we being humble and willing? Where else in our lives are there addictive patterns? Those in recovery have to be very careful to be willing to grow and change and move past old habits of relating and to put new spiritual values into their lives. How are the relationships in our life? What patterns have we developed, and how are they changing now? Are we willing to examine that part of our life and to ask for help in changing it? Here is an example from John. Humbly asked who? To remove what? Shortcomings? What are they? It seems as long as I kept asking these questions, even after getting answers from my sponsor and friends and from reading, I didn't have to take this step. It's like asking the question, why? Why is the unanswerable question for me? Just like little children when they ask why. When they get the answer, they ask why again and again and so on. I use the question like a hold-off on step 7. The fact is that when I took this step on one of my shortcomings, false pride, it gave me the opening I needed to continue to use this step as another self-knowledge step, like 4 and 5. Step 7 has the power of disconnecting from the old self. Certainly I have admitted my powerlessness, unmanageability, dishonesties, and childlike behavior, but they had become so much a part of me that I felt threatened to have these things removed. In fact, I considered my overreacting as a part of me that was useful, or at least it was just me, and people would have to learn to accept that about me. It's funny now, but as I received the knowledge of self, I realized that I had created the John R. Construction Company, and my specialty was walls. In the blink of an eye, I had walls erected that could keep out anyone, anything, even God. I had to file a bankruptcy notice and go through the process of surrendering all my shortcomings in order for me to get on to living without the safety of my old shortcomings. Certainly, I have still got some, but they are usually located in my pride locker. And when I am capable of an honest, humble reawakening, I will report my status to myself, to my home group, or friends in the fellowship. Of course, it is impossible for me to do that without giving it up for my higher power. So I stop building walls, make decisions, and act as if I want to be happy, serene, and sane, and go on trying to carry the message of spiritual awakenings. I know now that the best way to stay away from removing my own shortcomings is to accentuate my good characteristics and be honest about what is really a human limitation, not a character defect. I keep uppermost in my mind and heart all of those things that keep me from God, which stems from pride, mental laziness, dishonesty, and procrastination. My staying right size is in direct proportion to my gratitude for the life I have in recovery. Thank God he is working on them now. If he wasn't, I would not have written this. Looking beyond our addiction of choice to other areas of our lives allows us to see the addictive patterns in a lot of what we do and feel. Being willing to gain a new perspective is a large part of gaining humility and realizing that there may be much more to our difficulties than drinking and drugging and all the rest of it. We have a disease that affects our life. We need to be willing to see that and to go forward with changing it. With our higher power's help and with awareness, we can move closer to our true potential as useful spiritual beings. A new perspective can also be called the surrender attitude, as related by Nancy. A few years ago, I made a very fortunate discovery while going through a very difficult period in my recovery. As a result of this discovery, the seventh step became my way of dealing with the everyday business of living. The emotional impact of this discovery was very much like having a spiritual awakening. The feelings of exhilaration persisted for several weeks. For a while, I'd been working myself into a near collapse over my inability to handle my financial affairs. I make a good income, and I know there is no good reason for running out of money, yet time and time again I would overspend and borrow to make up for the deficit and run my charge cards to the limit. Of course, this particular time was not the first bit of despair I had felt about my money-handling habits. My careful budget and intentions to stick with it this time proved fruitless. I was very unhappy and discouraged. I felt inadequate and doubted my ability to manage my life and move ahead. I was becoming more and more desperate. Then, out of nowhere, came the thought that I was dealing with a serious character defect. I don't know why I hadn't seen it that way before, but I hadn't. I felt sure I could handle it on my own. Seeing it in the light of a character defect put a whole new spin on it. I knew I had better turn to God for help. I was by myself at home, so I did what Dr. Bob, AA's co-founder, always counseled newcomers to do. I fell on my knees and said out loud, "God, I need help. I can't handle this by myself." Almost immediately, I felt a sense of relief and hope. My mind began to clear, and I started having some good ideas about how to get myself out of the financial mess I'd created. Soon, I was able to put some of those ideas into action. Weeks later, I developed methods for keeping myself from falling into that financial sinkhole again. A couple of days after the initial discovery, I remembered two other surrender experiences that happened to me during my early recovery. The first resulted in my wholehearted acceptance of the program and having the compulsion to drink lifted from me. The second happened later and resulted in the resolution of a long-standing inner conflict that would have stood in the way of any possible long-term sobriety and serenity. I saw that the seventh step could be applied whenever I confronted a similar situation that seemed hopeless and helpless. Usually it involves my blindness to my own defects. Whenever I find myself uptight or bordering on panic, I fall on my knees, figuratively or literally if I can, and ask for God's help.